This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
I'm Alex Smith. And I'm here to pump you up.
It's more a matter of how do we survive. That's the most important thing we have to do, is survive and carry on our genes into the future and hope that a more capable human will evolve later on. But extending nuclear power or solar thermal energy won't turn back global heating. It'll only enable us to live more comfortably with it.
So spell that a little bit more for me. What do you mean? I mean, what will it take for us to survive?
Well, I think it'll take a lot of moving, migration from the hotter and drier areas of the world to the polar basin, for example, to islands and to oases in continents like North America. There's bound to be some oases in the Rockies where there's enough water to grow food.
Of course, the great population centers tend to be in those warmer climates right now. I mean, you're talking devastation coming up in decades.
I don't see anything terribly different from that, and I think our responses are much too slow and inappropriate for us to be able to do anything about it.
And how we get from where we are to there is basically people kill each other off, fighting over diminishing resources.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock, where the facts are never sanitized or irradiated before use. Those opening climate love letters are from Guy and James Lovelock and Whole Earther Stuart Brand in radio interviews on the show, to the best of our knowledge, on PRI. Top scientists, authors, and activists, the ones you want to hear. No fear, Deep Green Radio EcoShock. Join us. In this program, you'll hear about the new nuclear renaissance, the lobbyists, and the Greens, who want you to accept more reactors to prevent catastrophic climate change. I'll toss in one slightly tarnished hero, Dr. James Hansen, and a new interview with another combative doctor, Helen Caldicott. And running throughout, a stimulating podcast from Shelley Thomas urging us to drop the nuke bias. But first, a message for the idiots who made Al Gore snowmen in the Netherlands to prove there is no global warming, and all the American gumbos who posted snowfall videos in Texas, and Fox News who announced the end of climate change during a brief interlude of cold weather. Yes, it's time for the new Climate Denial Crock of the Week from Peter Sinclair.
Meanwhile, we've got this updated Fox News global warming alert. It is still cold. In fact, it is getting colder, much colder. Environmentalists telling me, duh, because it's winter. It is freezing!
We've heard a lot of talk lately from deniers that cold temperatures are proof that there is no such thing as global warming. It looks like it'll be an annual event for me to remind people that winter still follows summer. So, before we get started, a little review.
It was a cool summer, right? Chicago, New York, places like that. So how can it be global warming? This is how. Look at the context. These blue dots over North America represent below average temperatures for the summer, June, July, August, what we call climatological summer. But look at the context. They're lost in a sea of red dots across much of the rest of the globe, just a couple other blue dots here and there. Those red dots are above average temperatures. What that translates to in terms of a ranking for this summer and for August, globally, second warmest on record, period of record going back a little more than a century. June through August, globally, the third warmest on record. The oceans, which had cooled for a couple years, now recovered with a vengeance. August, the warmest on record. June through August, also the warmest on record. And in the southern hemisphere, August was the warmest on record.
The warm summer was followed up by a very warm November, globally, including abnormally warm temperatures in North America. Ironically, unseasonable warmth set the stage for dramatic winter weather, when temperatures did drop in December.
Well, let's talk about why we're seeing such a huge and significant lake effect event. The Great Lakes themselves, the water temperature there is still some 3 to 4 degrees warmer than it should normally be this time of the year. a gust of a very mild November. Now, again, this very cold air right now, it's about 17 degrees. The cold air is coming over these warm lakes, picking up all this moisture and dumping inch after inch of snow downwind. And people waking up on your Friday, dealing with perhaps 2 to 4 feet of snow.
People love to talk about the weather. And a series of strong storms and cold temperatures in December and early January sparked a lot of discussion. What scientists are telling us is that an important circulation pattern, the Arctic Oscillation, is in its negative phase. Normally, in the positive phase, the Arctic Oscillation produces strong winds around the Arctic that keep cold air bottled up. When the oscillation is in a negative phase, cold air spills out of the Arctic and flows into North America and Eurasia. Paradoxically, while temperate zones feel an Arctic chill, the Arctic itself becomes warmer than usual, exactly the effect that has been observed over the last several weeks. The UK Meteorological Office produced this map and described the observations. Canada, North Africa, the Mediterranean, and Southwest Asia have all seen temperatures above normal, in many places by more than 5 degrees centigrade, and in parts of northern Canada by more than 10 degrees. When we look at the graph of the monthly Arctic Oscillation Index, we can see that the current one is the strongest negative since the 1970s, which is why many people were surprised by the blasts of cold air that are expected under these conditions. One effect was on air circulation over Western Europe, which normally flows from the west over the Atlantic, delivering warmer air. Under the negative Arctic Oscillation, the warmer winds are blocked, and most of the airflow is cold Arctic winds, leading to snow and cold in many European countries. This diagram from NOAA shows the pattern of warmth in the Arctic and unusual cold in mid-latitudes around the Northern Hemisphere. Dr. Mark Serez, director of the National Snow and Ice Data Center, told Reuters news agency, "It's very warm over the Arctic, with air temperatures locally at 10 to 15 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than they should be in certain areas." This map from NASA also shows the pattern, which was well illustrated in a BBC report with graphics from the UK Met Office.
This Met Office map shows today's temperatures around the Northern Hemisphere. There's cold air over us, but warmer air elsewhere. Look further south and east. There's an unusually warm band of air there. Then, further east and over China, another very cold pocket.
But just as the Arctic was unseasonably warm, other areas of the globe were also not feeling the cold.
While much of the Northern Hemisphere suffers from one of the hardest winters in years, the thermometer is shooting way up, down under. On Monday, Melbourne was melting, with highs soaring to 110 degrees Fahrenheit. Monday night, Melbourne sweltered through its hottest night since 1902, with temperatures topping 34 degrees Celsius or 93 degrees Fahrenheit.
Most people think of global warming as a process where the planet sets new warming records year after year. A clearer picture comes in a new study from the National Center for Atmospheric Research, described here by senior scientist Gerald Meal.
But what we noticed was in the last 10 or 20 years, there's been this ratio of about 2 to 1. So there's been a roughly about, for every 2 record high maximum temperatures, there's only been 1 record low minimum temperature set on average over the U.S. We looked at a model simulation going off into the future. And in this model simulation, we had a scenario where we're increasing carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases going off into the 21st century. And as the climate continued to warm, this ratio continued to grow. So in other words, you kept having more and more record high maximum temperatures, fewer and fewer record low minimum temperatures. So by the mid-21st century, this ratio, which is now about 2 to 1, was about 20 to 1. By the end of the century, with this continued warming and this continued change in the distribution of records, the ratio is about 50 to 1. One of the messages of this study is that you still get cold days. Even at the end of the 21st century, in the model simulation, when the climate's warmed up by 3 or 4 degrees centigrade on average across the U.S., you're still setting record low minimum temperatures on a few days every year. So people always get very alarmed if there's a cold snap in the winter, and they say, well, what's happened to global warming? We're freezing out here. And you say, well, that's just the weather.
The Weather Channel, January 15, 2010.
The Northeast, we're talking temperatures well above average. Boston heading up to 43, warm in New York at 44. D.C., we are in the 50s. That's about 10 degrees above average. And no cold in the Midwest either. We are well above average here. Friday temperatures about 20 degrees above average in Bismarck at 39 degrees. We'll be warm in Kansas City. And Denver will be mild. And in Great Falls, Montana, about 20 degrees above average. The warmth hangs on Saturday all across the Midwest.
But in a technological, scientific world, our perception is greatly expanded, and we have a much larger view of the world and our place in it. We need to understand the larger perspective about our changing climate as well. Sophisticated instruments and advanced science show us the details that our senses could never see, and recent satellite measurements show that, in fact, on January 13th, global temperatures were the warmest for a January day in the satellite record. And this week, NASA released data showing that 2009 was the second hottest year in the instrumental record. We'll be looking more at this new data in coming weeks and months. The science of global climate is vital for us to understand if we are to pass along to our children a planet that is livable, diverse, and abundant. It's the most important task this generation will undertake, and you can keep track of our progress right here on Climate Denial, Croc of the Week.
Find that on YouTube. Just search for the Green Man 3610 channel. Temperature in the Netherlands on January 15th, 7 degrees Celsius or 44 degrees Fahrenheit. Guess what happened to the Al Gore snowman protest? It kind of melted away in the heat, just as most of these amateur denier sites will disappear in a few years. Let's get back to nuclear as the salvation of the world's climate. Before we hear Dr. Helen Caldicott from Australia, I want to introduce you to climatefilesradio.com. That's a good podcast from Shelley Thomas, who also runs Futurism Now, and a blog called Civilianism. I like Shelley's new climate podcast. You really get your hour's worth of news followed by useful clips and information. For example, I like Shelley's take on a greener internet. I had no idea our exchange of electrons was so damaging to the climate.
Welcome to Climate Files. This is Shelley Thomas. My new website is climatefilesradio.com, and you can contact me at news@climatefilesradio.com. And by all means, spread this podcast around wherever you can. I need a much bigger audience helping me spread this around because the UN is predicting that the disinformation campaign and the climate change deniers and skeptics movement is going to grow exponentially in 2010. To try to stop climate change legislation or the EPA regulations this year. So we have to counteract that with the truth. All right, the next story, Bell Labs launches global effort to make the internet 1,000 times greener by 2015. This would be great news if it's true, if it's possible. Bell Labs, the research arm of telecom giant Alcatel-Lucent, announced a bold and daring target of overhauling the internet and other communications networks so that they will be 1,000 times more energy efficient within only 5 years. The amount of energy consumed by networks equates to 300 million tons of planet-warming gases each year, about the same as 50 million cars. If Bell Labs and its new Green Touch consortium of partners can spur the technologies to hit that target, the internet could run for 3 years on the same amount of energy it now devours in a day. The 15 founding members of the consortium come from industry, universities, science labs, and NGOs. They include AT&T, China Mobile, Samsung Advanced Institute of Technology, and MIT's Research Laboratory for Electronics. Bell Labs called the announcement an open invitation to all members of the global information and communication technology sector to join. Recently, the industry lost its battle to be included in the Copenhagen Accord that came out of the two-week talks in December. Making no mention of failed global climate policy, Bell Labs insisted Green Touch would deliver a radical reengineering of global networks by 2015. The head of research Bell Labs, G. Rittenhouse, said this will be very, very different from the current network. Today's system is optimized around performance and simplicity of operation, not saving energy. So keep that in mind in the coming months and years and see what develops out of this. It's called Green Touch.
In the same podcast, Climate Files Radio number 55, Shelley makes her case that we need more nuclear power and especially new atomic tech to replace American dependence on coal-fired power plants. Here's a clip, including a jazzy piece she snapped off the net on thorium reactors.
We're going to have to shut down the coal plants. What will replace coal plants? A lot of people think that some type of nuclear power should be replacing coal plants because it's the only power that could step in and take over electricity production. So a lot of people are looking towards nuclear power. Now, before I get into that, I'm going to play about a 4-minute audio from a recent video on thorium reactors that will hopefully tell you everything you wanted to know about what a thorium reactor is. This is Climate Files, and the website is climatefilesradio.com.
Our planet has a problem. The world population is 6.8 billion people and growing rapidly, with no decline predicted. The world is demanding more and more energy now and at an ever-increasing pace into the future. There will be no future if fossil fuels are used to create the energy the world is demanding. Wind, solar, hydro, waste energy, algae, bioenergy, and conservation all together can never supply enough energy to meet the demand of a hungry world. The world needs to bring back an old idea for creating massive amounts of energy without creating any of the dangers or costs that current coal or nuclear plants create. That is LFTR, L-F-T-R, the Liquid Fluoride Thorium Reactor. LFTR is an electric power generator that uses inexpensive thorium as a fuel. It generates heat and electric power at a cost far less than using coal or any other source of energy. LFTR generators dissolve thorium and uranium in a circulating tank, allowing continuous refueling and waste removal. Successful LFTR power generators were created at Oak Ridge National Laboratories in the 1960s and 70s. Scientists in France, Japan, India, and Russia are creating thorium-based power plants right now. LFTR was the preferred power generation system of many researchers since World War II. Edward Teller promoted thorium energy until the month he died. The hugely beneficial aspects of thorium. You cannot use LFTR to create nuclear weapons. You cannot get runaway reactions or China syndromes. The units cannot overheat and automatically stop. LFTR will dispose of our spent nuclear waste stockpile. The United States has huge amounts of domestic supplies of thorium, enough to last well over 1,000 years. LFTR advantages. It uses a domestically produced, inexhaustible supply of inexpensive thorium. It consumes our nuclear waste, now stored at nuclear power plants, and turns it into cheap electricity. 1 ton of cheap, available thorium can create over 1 gigawatt of electric energy per year. Thorium is often found with rare earth metals. Rare earth metals make electric cars run. Cars that will run from thorium-produced electricity. It needs half the cooling of today's coal or nuclear plants and cannot overheat. It shuts its process off automatically. The LFTR produces less than 1% of the radioactive waste of today's nuclear power plants and can be air-cooled. Please join the Thorium Energy Alliance today and help tell the world that there is a solution here and now.
That music makes thorium reactors sound so sexy, doesn't it? I don't agree with him that renewable energy can't someday power the entire world. I think that it can. It's going to take a combination of some type of nuclear reactors, some types of other power plants maybe we haven't even envisioned yet, and renewable energies that we're aware of now. And that's where a thorium nuclear reactor might come in, as something that's very, very practical and much safer than traditional breeder reactors.
Doesn't that sound great? Why are green busybodies opposing this wonderful invention?
There's a lot of unnecessary fear out there of nuclear reactors. A very outspoken activist against nuclear reactors is making the rounds right now. She's a pediatrician. I'm not quite sure why she thinks she's an expert on nuclear power. But she's being well used right now and amping up the hysteria. I'd rather listen to actual nuclear scientists who say that this is safe. I have no reason not to believe them. I think people should be a lot more fearful of coal and the way coal is devastating our planet's atmosphere.
Yes, a pediatrician with 30 years investigating nuclear affairs, many books, and even more honorary degrees. What would she know? Let's talk with her now, Dr. Helen Caldicott, on Radio EcoShock. Why would the world's sixth largest oil producer announce plans to build four nuclear reactors? And here's another question. Is there a new generation of nuclear power waiting in the wings to replace climate-killing coal? I'm Alex Smith, and I don't have the answers. Today we'll talk to someone who does. She's Dr. Helen Caldicott, possibly one of the world's most famous anti-nuclear campaigners. Helen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with the Middle East. The United Arab Emirates has announced a new fleet of reactors. Can you tell us what they are up to?
Well, I think it's about male dominance and power and that ubiquitous hormone testosterone. The fact is that once you've got a nuclear reactor to make power, you've got a nuclear reactor to make bombs. It's one and the same thing. You only need one, really, like North Korea, to enter the portals of the nuclear club and be eminently, imminently powerful. And so there's a mad scramble by many, many countries now, knowing that they can make bombs, to build nuclear power plants under the guise of, well, it doesn't produce any CO2 or global warming, which is also totally untrue.
It's my understanding this Korean reactor design has never been built, much less tested. Is that correct?
I don't know about the Korean reactor design, but I do know that the two reactors nominated to be built in America, the AP1000 built by Westinghouse, or designed by Westinghouse, and the French reactor built by Areva, the Advanced Pressurized Reactor, APR. The NRC in America, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, has not licensed either of them, saying that there are too many faults in the designs, which are extremely dangerous. There are two reactors being built currently, one in Finland, one in France, of the Areva design, and they're way beyond due date, and they're also at twice the amount that they said they would be. So it's not working out well at all. They say that China's building a lot of reactors, but I haven't seen hard evidence that they've actually started building them.
Well, let's take this Korean deal with the UAE. An Asian country wins a contract to build reactors in the Middle East. Do you think that signals a geopolitical shift in nuclear affairs away from the West?
So it's a South Korean reactor that I hadn't read about that, nor have I read about a South Korean reactor design. I suspect it's probably an American design, but that I don't know. Does it signal new relationships with the Middle East? I'm not sure. I don't know what the relationship of South Korea is to the Middle East. I know they need oil, and I suspect they get their oil from the Middle East. I can't really comment any further on that.
All right. Well, you know, one thing I could say is that they've announced that they're going to build four reactors for the price tag of $20 billion. And to me, that sounds like a laughable underestimate. And I've been doing some digging around on this. And from what I've got out of the documents, it appears the Korean people could end up paying for any cost overruns. And surely they never voted for this. It seems just like another example of sort of power at the top going way beyond what the people would really accept.
Yeah, well, that happens all the time in the United States and Canada and Australia in terms of what they call defense, which is really war. The equipment that they build to kill people is very sophisticated. The people are never asked about it. There's never a vote taken. And America actually is spending about nearly $1 trillion a year, if you count everything, on weapons and mass killing. Those sort of huge decisions right at the top are almost dictatorial decisions with no recourse to the public at large. $5 billion is, a gross underestimate for a reactor. Now, the Wall Street and Moody's are pricing them at about $12 to $15 billion each for a 1,000-megawatt reactor. Have you read anything about what this design is that the South Koreans are smooting?
I have looked into it a little bit, and they have a reactor that they're building that they think will open in 2013 or 2014, and that's the design that they're selling the United Arab Emirates. But as they say, it hasn't opened. We don't know whether it'll really work or not. So I'm almost wondering whether this isn't nuclear vaporware. But, you know, another thing, Helen, that allows the Emirates perhaps to build it more cheaply than it would be built in America is they have a history of using construction workers from India and Asia, and they pay them very lowly, and they keep them in very poor conditions. And I wonder whether inexperienced and unhappy workers will impact the final safety of these nuclear plants if they are built.
Well, I think that's an obvious question and an obvious answer. No. Now, I often think about war and how we've got this huge arsenal of nuclear weapons still ready to go with 3-minute decision time, and everyone assumes that they're run and controlled by rational people. And the more I look at, for instance, the politics of the United States at the moment and these Tea Partiers and Sarah Palin, who's almost totally ignorant, she's an ignoramus, and how people are flocking to her and to others out of really superstition and lack of knowledge and rationality. And if you look back at history, some of the most dreadful things are done out of superstition from the midbrain, not the neocortex. And so unhappy workers obviously more prone to not concentrate, to make mistakes, and the like. I mean, we only need to think of when we've had a fight with our spouse or we've got impending flu and how we feel, how we make mistakes, and we're almost not responsible for what we do. So, yes, I think your point is well taken.
Well, as you know, with India, the George Bush administration has helped a new wave of proliferation get going. And it was the Bush administration who opened the door for the UAE to get their reactors. But it was the Obama team, one of their early acts in office in May. They said, yes, we're going to approve this. And the pact has been signed on December 17, 2009. So I wonder if you've seen other signs that President Obama is nuclear friendly.
He has not come down firmly on either side of the nuclear power issue. He seems to kind of have an open mind and be vacillating, but I know that Stephen Chu, Secretary of Energy, is very pro-nuclear. He comes from Los Alamos Labs, where they build the nuclear weapons and design them. I also know that John Holdren, his science advisor, he's very good on nuclear weapons and proliferation and eradication of same, but he's also likes Generation 4 reactors, which are the most satanic machines ever devised by man, run by plutonium, cooled by liquid sodium, which is explosive, plutonium being the most carcinogenic, dangerous substance there is on Earth. So, and it only needs 5 kilos to make a bomb, a nuclear bomb, atomic bomb. So he's in the hands of people who I wouldn't trust in this area as far as I could kick them. He needs advice from physicians and medical people about nuclear power. I need actually just half an hour with Obama one-to-one. He's highly intelligent. He's got little girls, and I'm sure I could educate him about the inherent dangers of nuclear power. And I would say that when the next meltdown occurs, and if it's particularly if it's in North America, that will signal the absolute end of nuclear power. And it's not if, but when. I asked a nuclear engineer the other day, what do you think the risks of a meltdown are? And he was an American. He said 1 in 10 in the next 10 years. And he was applying that to the U.S.
Well, right. They've been updating a lot of the old reactors, just giving them extension after extension, and eventually they are going to go. We'll be right back in 60 seconds with more from Dr. Helen Caldicott on the new nuclear power.